Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Christmas in August on the Savage Nation. I think I'm going to play Christian songs and music about Christmas, Christians. Get the word Christmas in as much as I can, since we're being assaulted by the Sharia law pushers. I think it's time to reaffirm our own faith in the Founding Fathers and in America itself. Now, I was asked this morning to comment on the mosque story for the Washington Times. And she said, what do you think about this mosque madness? Do you think it's being used to cover up Obama's horrendous failures, especially with the unemployment and the economy? He's off to another vacation in Martha's Vineyard, the eighth one this year. Unbelievable. And I said, no, this is not mosque madness. This is mosque sadness. That a radical imam and a militant Arab developer would attempt to trample on America's raw nerve about 9/11 indicates to me that this is more than a media phenomenon. The Ground Zero Mosque has touched all thinking Americans who now see more clearly the ongoing battle between militant Islam and the West. You see, with over 100 mosques in New York City, why did these agitators want to provoke America like this? Why did Obama take their side instead of being a diplomatic leader like Governor Patterson, who offered another location in Manhattan? This is yet another victory mosque that will be viewed throughout the Muslim world as a yet another insult to the liberal weak West, I wrote. And contrary to Obama and Bloomberg, this is not about freedom of religion, but about the site itself. Even the head of Al Arabiya Television, himself a Muslim, calls Ground Zero a cemetery of 9/11 victims, and he wrote that it would be a victory for Islamists. Sure, this incident is obscuring Obama's failures on the economy and on so many other fronts, but not for very long. He's leaving on yet another vacation, this time to Martha's Vineyard, where the grapes of economic wrath are stored and the vintage wine of a depression is being brewed. The people see it all, believe me. Now, one of the reasons we're having these problems in America, where we get people saying things and people can't even refute them, is because we've gone from the age of reason to the age of belligerence. Okay, and that's one of the principal reasons the West has lost, is because of the loss of reason. Let me repeat that. One of the reasons that this country became so great so fast is because of reason. Because it was rooted in the Bible. It was rooted in Aristotelian logic, right? But we've lost our age of reason, as evidenced by the statements that are being made today by politicians, even by some in the media. For example, today a statement was made by an individual on CNN who tried to compare the building of a mosque on Ground Zero to the theoretical construction of a Catholic church at the Oklahoma City bombing site, saying that because McVeigh was Catholic, it would make no sense to build a church. It made no sense what he was talking about. There was no logical description of what the man was talking about. And this is one example of many of the loss of reason, even among the so-called educated people in the media. What we have instead is an age of belligerence, where people make false statements on the basis of their belief system, and they think they're correct simply because they made the statement. They can't reason. There's no logic. There are no consequences for these false statements. And as a result, people don't care about responsibility. They cannot follow any logic as to what they're doing and what their actions will lead to. They have been taught in our schools to have no reason, to not believe in logic, to simply follow their feelings. If it feels good, do it. Why not do it in the road? So you see, all of the propaganda of the 1960s has come home to roost, even amongst our leadership. Witness Obama. He makes statements and doesn't even give a damn about their consequences. He takes vacations without understanding the debilitating effect they have on the American people, millions of whom are out of work. And then we have the clash of civilizations. The liberal left versus the belligerent Muslim countries. Who do you think is going to win when you have liberals in the West, like Bloomberg, who continuously bend over backwards to explain away the belligerence of the Muslim world? Who wins that battle? Can you play that one out on your logic board? Play the battle hymn of the Republic, and I'll take your calls at 1-800-449-8255. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. And we're going to hear, I hope, the right song. What is this, my friends?
Mine eyes have seen the glory.
I'll turn this
of
off.
Coming.
Gee, what are you doing to me? What? I never heard of anything like this. The whole point of playing the battle hymn of the Republic is for the one line. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. Why? Because Obama's going to Martha's Vineyard. I thought I could tell a joke. Why Martha's Vineyard? Because not only are the grapes of wrath stored there, that's where the grapes of wrath have been used to make us a vintage depression. All of the bankers that gave us Obama are in Martha's Vineyard in August. All of them. Every one of them goes to Martha's Vineyard in order to plot the next takedown in America, in order to plot the next bubble so that you can be used as cannon fodder for the next war, the next economic war. Now, where is Nancy Pelosi after she called for a witch hunt against the 70% of American people opposed to the mosque? Where is she? It's astounding to me that a politician as prominent as she could call for a McCarthy-like witch hunt and get away with this. Now, imagine if we had a Republican president and a Republican Speaker of the House, let's say Newt Gingrich was the Speaker, and there was a contentious issue about building a church somewhere, and Newt Gingrich would come out and say, I think there should be an investigation of those opposed to the building of the church. Well, may I ask you something? Who would conduct Nancy Pelosi's witch hunt? Would it be the FBI? Would it be Homeland Security? Would it be the House of Representatives? Would it be Naval Intelligence? Would it be some other agency of the U.S. government? Nancy Pelosi has made a statement that should put chills up your spine, but I've long ceased thinking that any liberal is actually telling the truth. They could care less about the truth. They don't care about the First Amendment. They care nothing about the Constitution. They only use these tools to approach their agenda with dignity. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Now, even Howard Dean, as whack jobby as he is, has come out and said that Ground Zero Mosque is a bad idea. That's Howard Dean, though. Former head of the DNC, if I remember correctly. Howard Dean, liberal in good standing, a deacon in the Church of Liberalism. Howard Dean came out and said, not a good idea. Listen to clips 2 and 3.
This isn't about the rights of Muslims to have a worship center, or Jews or Christians or anybody else to have a place to worship, where any place or Ground Zero. This is something that we ought to be able to work out with people of good faith. And we have to understand that it is a real affront to people who lost their lives, including Muslims. That site doesn't belong to any particular religion. I think a good, reasonable compromise could be worked out without violating the principle that people ought to be able to worship as they see fit. I think another site would be a better idea, again, but I would look to do that with the cooperation of the people who are trying to build the mosque. This is a very delicate, difficult religious and cultural issue.
So we have two prominent Democrats, both of whom are as lockstep leftists as they come, Howard Dean and Harry Reid, who have said that it's not a good idea to build a mosque here, and they know why. And both of them actually know what's going on, and both of them understand that this is not simply a mosque. They understand that these are thugs who are trying to build this. These thugs want to build a Ground Zero structure to insult America. There are those who are saying these will be victory tribute safe houses and a staging ground for future terrorist acts. I don't believe that. But make no mistake that the enemy of freedom is operating in plain sight. I'll be right back.
Savage. wouldn't say that the United States deserved what happened, but the United States policies were an accessory to the crime that happened.
Okay. Are you saying that we're an accessory?
Yes.
How?
Because we have been an accessory to a lot of innocent lives dying in the world. In fact, in the most direct sense.
Shut this crook off. That's the New York City mosque leader, Faisal Abdul Rauf, who's in hiding in the Middle East with State Department money. Hillary Clinton should be ashamed of herself funding this man's hiding trip. He's on a trip to hide. And that was him being interviewed by Ed Bradley on 60 Minutes, 19 days after the 9/11 attacks, calling the United States an accessory to the attacks. And by the way, he's not alone in this. If you scratch the skin of 90% of liberals, especially on the Upper East Side of New York, they would agree with him. 90% of the liberals on the Upper East Side of New York would walk into a country. I've never seen anything like this. And I'm going to speak out against it. People say to me, why are you still talking about it? Well, what should I do? Wait for the political class to talk about this? This is an outrage. The mosque has to be stopped. I don't care about the provocateurs who are trying to build it. You got to stop it. And you got to stop it, and it can be stopped. Yes, it can be stopped. There are zoning issues. In addition to the ethical and moral issues, there are zoning issues that they have trampled upon. Even Howard Dean has come out and said no. Harry Reid, one of the most powerful political figures in the country. You should enlist them to stop this mosque. That's all. 1-800-449-8255. Tom in New York on WOR. Your opinion counts. Go ahead, please.
God bless you, Michael. Michael, you know what? This does, this Ground Zero mosque does violate the rule of law. The will of the people, and this country was founded on majority rule, the will of the people demanded that that plot be landmarked, a war memorial, at a rogue government that just ignores that. This is not just sensibility, Michael. This violated the will of the people.
Well, look, here's a time poll that comes out that says 24% of Americans think that Obama is a Muslim. Now, that was conducted before the mosque issue. What do you think the number would be today?
Michael, he's not ruling as if he represents the people. Michael, the Jews, Catholics, and Protestants have to rise up and resist this in a democratic fashion.
But where are religious leaders on this? Almost all of the religious leaders, so-called, are liberals, pacifists, without guts. The only one who opposes the mosque is Franklin Graham. Do you know that?
Michael, the Catholic leaders have come out against this. They need to be more forceful.
Wait a minute. Which Catholic leader has come out against this?
The Cardinal of New York, and I believe...
Well, good for him. But let me tell you something. There's a group called the Interfaith Alliance, which is a group of left-wing fanatics. They're the same group that tried to pin the tail of hatred upon me several times. They're nothing but a bunch of left-wing vermin from the swamp, but they put the badge of religion over them so people are afraid to say a word to them. They're not religious leaders of any kind. The real religious leaders oppose this.
Michael, why does the Islamic religion get a pass on not controlling the so-called militant wing of their religion? Jews don't get that pass, Catholics don't get that same pass, and neither do Protestants. Why does Islam get...
My friend, look, we know the answer to this. When I have just played a tape of the New York City mosque leader, Abdul Rauf, saying that we're basically responsible for the 9/11 attack, and right now Rauf is in hiding in the Middle East with State Department money, and the developer is a militant Arab, what does that tell the people about who is behind the mosque? I rest my case. I've heard over and over again the garbage that it's religious freedom, and I keep saying to you, it's not about the religion, it's not about the mosque, because there are 100 mosques in New York City. It's not about the freedom of religion or freedom of worship, because there's 100 mosques in Manhattan. It is about the site, which is a sacred site. In fact, the head of Arabiya Television, who himself is a moderate Muslim, also an educated man, unlike most of the Muslims that are being heard today who are not educated at all, many of the Muslims speaking out loudest today are jailbirds who got their religion in prison. They're uneducated. They know only the one book, the Quran. They've read almost nothing else. We're being dragged back into the ninth century. Don't you understand what this is all about? An educated Muslim who wants to get along with Christians and Jews and others would say, if there's this much of an outcry, maybe we're wrong. Maybe there's a sensitivity we didn't see. You know what? You're right. We'll move it. It's not a big deal. We're not wed to being at the Burlington Coat Factory. We don't have to keep putting our finger in the eye of America. After all, we'd like to assimilate. They don't want to assimilate, you schmuck. They want you to become them. You putz, when the hell are you going to wake up to what they're doing to you? You want to find out what Sharia law is? Would you like to hear the story of what Sharia law is? Huh? Would you like to hear where they want to take you back to the 5th century? You hear the words, oh, Sharia law, it's so mild. Really? A Saudi judge has asked several hospitals in Saudi Arabia whether they could damage a man's spinal cord as punishment after he was convicted of attacking another man with a cleaver and paralyzing him. So in other words, the man's brother who was hurt said that according to a Muslim law, Islamic law, we have a right to demand that this man be punished accordingly, and we want our legal right under Islamic law, the brother said. There is no better word than God's word, an eye for an eye. So they've taken him to a hospital, and they want to find out if a doctor in Saudi Arabia will damage the man's spinal cord to paralyze him. Now, under the law, meaning Sharia law, again, the 5th century law that they like to impose upon you, the victim can receive blood money to settle the case. But the family said, we don't want blood money. We don't want it. We want the attacker to be paralyzed. And so we want his spine severed. Isn't that amazing that you don't even know what Sharia law is? You keep hearing it's just mild this and mild that. Wake up. What world are you living in? There is a war going on, and most Americans don't even know that they're non-combatants in this war. They don't even know that they're non-combatants. They don't even know what war is going on. This is the war to end all wars. This is the war to end all wars. It's a silent, stealth, cultural war.
Savage.
Welcome back to the one and only Savage Nation. We're going to turn to Iran right now and the dangerous situation of the Hitler of our time, Ahmadinejad, who has threatened to annihilate Israel on many occasions, who is on the brink of achieving a nuclear bomb. Joining us right now to discuss this issue is Dr. Malcolm Hohnlein, who is the executive vice chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and has been since 1986. Dr. Hohnlein, welcome back to the Savage Nation. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Savage.
Well,
great to be here.
So what's the situation with Iran? You know, we've been hearing this for years, that they're about to get the bomb. They're going to get the bomb. It'll be too late. Once they get the bomb, what do you think is going to happen? Is someone going to stop them, or is this a fait accompli?
Well, it's rapidly becoming a fait accompli if the Western world and the United States doesn't make a decision soon. You know, we keep talking about the options being on the table, but at some point we have to go to the table. And this weekend, in fact, there's going to be a critical threshold crossed. On Saturday, there's going to be a ceremony near the southern Iranian city of Bushehr, which is where Russia will begin the process of loading fuel rods into Iran's first so-called civilian nuclear reactor. Now, this is a low-enriched uranium, but we know from the North Korean model, which is exactly what Iran emulates all the time. It follows the example of North Korea. When North Korea announced that they had the nuclear bomb and nothing happened, that's what's inspired Iran to do the same thing, and they work together. It's all collaborative. They exchange technology, and they exchange nuclear capacity, as well as military weapons. The Bushehr event will be an act of defiance against the U.S. and the international community by Russia as well, and it's a sign of, you know, not only of their desire for the income, because they make $1 billion off of this, and plus all the ongoing income from taking the spent uranium and enriching it, but it's also a political statement on their part at a time when we're all trying to push the sanctions regime, and it seems to be having some impact. Russia then goes ahead and after a 10-year delay now decides to allow this thing to go online, and once, as you know, it's online, you can't take it out. This is separate, though, from the string of reactors which are producing for the nuclear weapons program. Many of those are inside mountains. There are at least 3 or 4 of them active, and they've announced they're going to build 10 more. And you know that the message to the rest of the Arab world, the Muslim world, if they get away with it, we are going to see an onslaught. 30 countries have already applied to the UN to ours.
I don't believe this. So it seems to me that this brinksmanship, the game of chess, has already been won by Russia. Once Russia went in, what are we going to do? I mean, even if there was will within the Obama administration and Israel to stop this, which I don't think there is, it can't be done anymore. Or am I mistaken?
Well, it could be done because this particular reactor we don't have to take out to stop the nuclear weapons program. But if you remember, what the Koreans did was they built this, quote, light water reactor and then kicked out the IEA and everybody else and then started enriching at a higher level. This could be done with the Bushehr reactor as well. But for now, the decision has to be made regarding the other capacity where they are producing and have 4,000 centrifuges operative already and many more online, and announce what they're doing. I mean, they challenged the West, and they say, we're not, you know, Khomeini now and Ahmadinejad announced today they're not going to sit down with the United States unless they meet their preconditions and unless they come to their terms, meaning that they allow them to be nuclear and they stop all the sanctions, etc. So what we did is we sent them a signal by the engagement process that they can get away with it. They've been doing it for, 18 years? And again, we keep sending a message, and they perceive it then as the weakness and lack of will and determination on the West, and that is the key.
But Dr. Hohenlein, there's a few questions raging in my mind. I've seen this go on for 2 years, that once Iran gets the bomb, they're going to use it, which he, you know, Ahmadinejad is a certifiably belligerent fanatic who believes that in order for the peace to reign on Earth, is it the 13th Mahdi has to reappear, and that can only occur after the apocalypse? He's an apocalyptic lunatic. He's just liable to use that bomb in Israel.
Right.
Look, well, am I reading this wrong, or is that, in your opinion, a fact?
Oh, that's a very realistic possibility. Thank God it's not a fact yet. But you're absolutely right, and this is something people tend to dismiss. They make fun of him. This is a shrewd guy. He plans everything, even his Holocaust denial. All the things he does with a specific intent. He's appealing to a certain audience, and he says, I'm ready to have half of Iran destroyed because you need an apocalyptic event to bring the hidden imam back who died in the 9th century, and this is part of his fanatic religious belief. In addition, he never has to use the bomb to have the intimidation and to be able to threaten and to establish himself and the hegemony he wants in the region. You have two now powers competing for dominance in the Arab Middle East, and neither is Arab. You have Turkey with Erdogan, who talks about reasserting the Ottoman Empire, and Ahmadinejad, who wants to reassert the Persian Empire.
And now the good news is that opposed to them is the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which is a Sunni kingdom, is that correct?
That is correct, and Jordan, and Egypt, and many others are against them. But they see that the West is capitulating in the face of these threats, and then they say, you know, we're not going to be left behind. One, they're going to do their own nuclear programs, which means this arms race will rage out of control. But two, they say, we can't rely on the West. And one of the indicators is that they look at what is the strength of the relationship with Israel, because they say, if Israel can't rely on them, we certainly have no chance.
But I understand Saudi Arabia has already given Israel the green light to fly south over their airspace if they do choose to strike this or other reactors. Is that a known fact, or is this all surmisal, I suppose?
It's not a known fact. It's a report that has been widely circulated, and it came after supposed indications that they wouldn't be allowed to fly over Iraq. I don't believe either one of those assertions yet are fact. I think it's certainly in Saudi Arabia's interest, and they all want to see Israel do the dirty work for all of them, and then they'll condemn them.
Yes.
But when Israel took out the nuclear reactor in Syria about a year ago, if you remember, not one Arab country except Syria criticized it. Not one. Because this is their future.
Well, that's right. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia would easily be blackmailed by an Iran with an atomic bomb. We understand that. So having said all of this, I mean, you know, like the angels on the head of a pin, can you make a prediction of what is going to happen, might happen, in plain English for the people listening to the show tonight? Do you actually think that the U.S. under Obama would permit an attack on Iran to take out the nuclear facility? Because once they are, once they go to the lighter heavy water situation and an attack occurs, I understand the radiological damage to civilians will be inevitable, and then it's too late to attack them. Isn't that true?
That is correct. That is, if when these other reactors are hot, the radiation then becomes a severe problem and challenge. There's another challenge potentially that now that Russia's sold this, if they sell the S-300 anti-aircraft system, which is the most sophisticated, that's a game changer. The Israelis and the United States can't allow that to happen because once they're in place, the cost of any kind of a military action. And there are interim steps that could be taken. You know, we have two big aircraft carriers there, and if you want to know what's going to happen, watch their movements and you'll see. Because the capacity we have is to embargo, we can lock off Iran, we can cut off the energy supplies to them. The sanctions have had a dramatic impact. So there are steps that we can take before an all-out attack. The question is, are we prepared if everything else fails? And it's the question you're posing. And the very question that people have is that they're not assured. They have no sense and conviction that the West will do what is necessary. What price did North Korea pay?
None.
For throwing out the IA and going nuclear and threatening the whole region?
None.
Let alone
but
thinking.
Dr. Hohnlein, I get excited because I'm watching history repeat itself. I believe in the almost the Jungian archetype situation. I believe Ahmadinejad is a repeat of Hitler. That's my own position. You know, go King Haman, you go down the list, Hitler, Ahmadinejad. They're exactly the same. But whereas Hitler invaded one country after the other and was not stopped and became emboldened at each step, the man is doing the same thing with his demands and threats, and nobody seems to stand up to him. There is no willpower in the West, and I don't personally think it's going to occur from Israel. Do you, or is there any way that you think Israel would actually act in its own self-defense at this late stage of history?
I do believe that Israel will do what's necessary. I think Prime Minister Netanyahu recognizes the seriousness of this. Answer to the question will be whether the United States will block it if Israel makes the decision, or will the United States make the decision, because it's a lot easier for the U.S. to do it. We also have, you know, Israel doesn't have any aircraft carriers. They have submarines that are now in the Persian Gulf. They have other capacities. They can do it if it's ultimately necessary. I don't think you can eradicate the nuclear program, but you can set it back to the Middle Ages, and you can attack the Iran Revolutionary Guard headquarters and many other things. Your analogy about Hitler, and I know that many of the listeners will say, it's an exaggeration. It's not. Look what this guy, how he came to power, how he manipulates the population. Hitler didn't have a billion people that you're appealing to. Now, it's true that many of the Arabs reject him and many of the Muslims reject him, but he plays to that street. And when you have a nuclear capacity in a country like Pakistan and others that could be mobilized in this kind of an effort if he were to be let loose, I think the analogy is not a lost one. I think it's very important that people understand how serious this moment is.
Well, at the risk of going even further out on a limb, I said this to a friend of mine the other day who's a physicist and thinks theoretically. I said, it's interesting to me that Hitler was not even a German. He was an Austrian. And that I know Iranians who say that Ahmadinejad is not even an Iranian. He's from a Turkoman background. Now, I say, well, what does that have to do with anything? It's just, to me, the analogy is very phenomenal to me. There seem to be currents throughout history that repeat themselves. And now we have a supine West with its head in the sand, buried in a lost cause within its own self, not even knowing how to save its own identity, and unwilling, frankly, to stand up to one of the most dangerous threats that I've seen in my lifetime. Now, I want to say to the listeners to this show who may be saying, what the heck do I care about Israel? Let them fight their own battles, because I've heard that argument. I believe that any logic would dictate that what happens in Israel or to Israel is indicative of what's going to happen to Europe and then America next. And I have often said Israel is the canary in the coal mine, so to speak, for all of the Western civilization. Would you agree with that analogy?
I agree with it, and I would go one step further. Israel won't even be the first target. First target that they've gone after was Bahrain, the Gulf, the undermining the regimes in Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Egypt, Jordan. They will destroy the region. And Israel, as you said, is the primary target. It is the canary, because Israel becomes the target. the minor devil to attack the big devil, which is the United States. That's the real target. And read what Osama bin Laden and these guys say, and what Ahmadinejad said. They say it to us, and the problem is that we don't take it seriously when dictators tend to tell the truth.
Yes.
Democracies lie, but dictators tell the truth.
It's true. Well, it's true. It's absolutely true. They speak from the heart, don't they?
Right, and they declare it, and then we don't take it seriously.
When Hitler wrote Mein Kampf in prison, he then, when he became dictator, carried out what he wrote in Mein Kampf. So we have to believe that when Ahmadinejad says when he gets the bomb, he's going to wipe Israel off the map, and he doesn't care if half of Iran is killed. I believe him.
And Hitler published it in 1924, 9 years before he got elected. And he said there everything he was going to do. Ahmadinejad's writing says everything he's going to do. And it's Osama bin Laden in his early tapes who says that the test is who has the will and determination. And he said the West lacks it. Americans have no patience. And the truth is we want everything over in 30 minutes, 60 minutes, at most a miniseries. We have no patience for anything more. That's not the way the world works. And if people don't have the willingness, the staying power to really carry it out, if we pull out and leave Iraq a mess that will destabilize everything and pose as big a threat to the Arab countries, to their neighbors, because Iran is active there. Iran will become more active there. And Iran is in South America. Look what they're doing with Chavez. In Mexico, they just uncovered Hezbollah networks, and they have training camps all over South America into Mexico.
Wait a minute. Hezbollah's in Mexico now?
And the government just broke and this is not hypothetical. I mean, I don't say things that I can't prove and can't demonstrate.
Wait, I want to confirm what you just said. You said that Hezbollah training camps have been found in Mexico now?
And they found them tied to the drug cartels and to Chavez. Chavez has facilitated Iran coming in. And what does it do? It puts them in a position to be 2 hours off our coast. He doesn't have to fight us from 8,000 miles away. And it means bringing
this is amazing to me. I mean, I'm not surprised by what you say, although I am shocked by it, in the sense that this ties into the whole issue of borders and the issue with the president who wants to attack Arizona for wanting to defend their own border from the drug cartels, amongst others. This is an amazing story. Dr. Hohnlein, I hope you can stay with us for a few minutes, because I want to ask you the following question as a follow-up. Years ago, Israel attacked Iraq when Saddam was about to build a nuclear a weapon. They blew it up. It was one of those amazing feats in modern warfare, in modern air warfare. And, of course, the opposition to Israel's attacking Iraq at that time was probably equal to the opposition to Israel attacking Iran now. Would that be a fair analysis, or was it even higher then than it is now?
Even the United States condemned Israel, if you remember, at the time. And now we recognize how many lives Israel saved of our own troops by what it did, given the situation in Iraq. But
all right. Another question then. When Israel attacked, what was the name of the plant? I forget it, in Iraq at that time.
Iraq.
Huh?
Osirak.
Okay, Osirak. The F-16s that they used to fly came back with zero fuel. It was so well calculated and so close. The planes landed with almost zero fuel on them when they got back to Israel, if I remember correctly. Was Russia at that time at all meddling in that affair? I'll take your answer from you, please, when we return right here on the Savage Nation. There's Dr. Malcolm Hohnlein, who knows what he's talking about. He is the executive vice chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. And wait a minute. You have to understand something. This organization that I'm mentioning is an umbrella group for all of the other major Jewish organizations in America. So I think that what you're going to hear is coming directly, so to speak, from the horse's mouth. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. We're diverting today from the Ground Zero Mosque and Hezbollah in Mexico for a discussion we've been having with Dr. Malcolm Hohnlein, who is the Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, which is the number one umbrella group for all the major Jewish groups in the United States of America. And I've asked Dr. Hohnlein to comment about the time years ago when Israel dared take out the Iraq, the nascent Iraq nuclear plant, in one of the most astonishing feats in the history of air warfare. Was there an opposition to that at that time equal to, less than, or more than you see today? Dr. Hohenlein, what do you think?
I think it was equal to, and it was a much simpler operation. It was only one reactor that had to be taken out, and they had to do it before it went hot. It was being built by the French, and again, all of the Arab world was waiting for Israel to do it, wanted Israel to do it, but of course joined the whole United Nations and the whole world in condemning Israel for carrying it out. You know, they wink and they nod and they tell Israel, go, you got to decimate Hamas, the Hezbollah, you got to take on Syria, you got to do all of this, but we'll condemn you once you do it. And that, of course, happened as well.
But so at the end of the day, because we have less than a minute left, do you actually think Israel's going to do what needs to be done to save their existence? Because my feeling is if they don't, they're going to be nuked.
Israel will not allow never again to be a hollow phrase. It's a pledge that every generation now renews, and this is not just for Jews. What Israel represents to the Middle East, what it represents to the world. Iran is not a threat to Israel alone. If, God forbid, they attack Israel, they will be attacking the U.S. Their missiles today can hit all of Europe. They will soon be able to hit the United States. They have long-range ballistic missiles. They have chemical and biological weapons. Israel announced today that they're building safeguards for Jewish populations, for the populations in Israel, because they recognize it. I think Netanyahu will not allow that threat.
Dr. Malcolm Hohenlein, thank you very much for being with us on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. We're talking about Pelosi's poison, where she said that anyone who opposes the Ground Zero Mosque should be investigated. And so Pelosi, who has come up from the swamp of San Francisco, is now attempting to drag the First Amendment into that swamp. We can talk about that. Death panels begin as reform takes shape. We warned you there would be death panels once Obamacare took hold. You said we were right-wing lunatics. Read Investor's Business Daily, and they're going to tell you that the death panels are very real, and they will take shape. And all of this goes on as the Obamas begin to take the sixth holiday of the year at the Massachusetts island known as Martha's Vineyard, the playground of the American banking system. Those in the investment community are well known to fly their private jets to Martha's Vineyard and circulate with each other so they can plan their next vintage of economic woe for the average American. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. I would also like to direct you to the website, of course, because I'm very proud of my book, Trickle Up Poverty, in that it's not out yet. It won't be out for 2 months. It's already number 6 on the political book list. Stopping Obama's Attack on Our Borders, Economy, and Security. I think it's a great book. And I want to say something that's very important because the point's not been made by anyone yet. People think that Obama is taking from the rich to give to the poor. This is the deceit. I wrote this book to prove definitively that, like all Marxists, he's taking from the middle class to give to the rich. This is something that needs to be understood if you're to prevent another communist revolution from occurring on the globe. What you don't understand is this. Why would a guy like George Soros, go out of his way to try to elect a man like Obama? Is it because George Soros wants more people to thrive in America, more people to thrive within the middle class of America? No, the opposite. A guy like George Soros, who has made countless billions of dollars in his lifetime, sometimes by trying to destroy the currency of England, another time trying to destroy the currency of Malaysia, trading money, whatever he has to do to make his billions, and then he funds radical left-wing causes. Why? Because people who meet on Martha's Vineyard don't like the middle class. People who meet on Martha's Vineyard who elected their puppet Obama, in fact, want to destroy the middle class in order to continue to profit themselves. Now you say, well, why would they want to do that? In my opinion, as I explain in Trickle Up Poverty, why do I say Obama has targeted the middle class? Because in a Marxist society, it's a two-class, Marxist societies are two-class societies. The ruling elite, the Politburo is part of the ruling elite. And then, of course, there's the peasant, the peon, the nothing. And so there's a very small or non-existent middle class in true Marxist societies. America has been known, if known for anything, for its very large middle class. It's what defined us as a nation. And so now we see the first president in American history whose every measure has targeted the American middle class, whether it be economic measures or health measures or military measures or cultural measures. They're all targeting the average guy and doll in the middle class. The Ground Zero Mosque, you may say, what does it have to do with it? It's part of the same program. If it affronts the middle class's Christian beliefs, good. That's what we want. We're left-wingers, and we want to get in their face. We want to see more mosques in America. We want to see the churches hollowed out and turned into other things. We want to see America lose its cultural identity. That's what a Marxist does. That's what Obamanomics has done. That's what Obama's doing. And that's why I say trickle-up poverty is more than about the economy. It's about his attack on every level of our society, our borders. Why would he attack Sheriff Joe in Arizona instead of attacking the drug cartels? Why would he go to war with the people of Arizona instead of going to war with the government of Mexico? Because he wants America to be weakened and to melt down, stopping Obama's attack on our borders, economy, and security. Okay, Trickle Up Poverty, my new book, is your best defense against the Obamanomics that are dragging the middle class and everyone else into a Marxist socialist death spiral. Okay, pre-order it now on Amazon.com. More as the time evolves. The book is going to be a monster hit. I don't need you to tell me that. And I didn't write it to make a fortune. I wrote it, truthfully, to interfere with the American election. That's right. I want to interfere with the plans that Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod have for reelecting Obama in 2012 and making sure that the Democrats retain their seats in November. That's right. The book is targeted directly at them. I'll be right back.
Savage.
You know, I got to tell you something. It's August. We're relaxing a little bit. We have a big guest coming up at 4:30. But I just went to the Amazon page that says other books buy, and it shows authors like me. You know what I mean? Like in the conservative realm, blah, blah, blah. And it says other books buy, and it shows all the other authors who are like-minded, in addition to Michael Savage. Complete Book of Homeopathy, Herbs That Heal, Maximum Immunity, Earth Medicine, Earth Food, The Taster's Guide to Beer, The Art of Feeding Children Well, Weiner's Herbal, The Way of the Skeptical Nutritionist, Reducing the Risk of Alzheimer's, Getting Off Cocaine, The Herbal Bible, The People's Herbal. You know, I've been writing books. I've been writing since I'm 16, but my first book was published in 1972. I'll never forget the excitement of that book, Earth Medicine, Earth Food. It's still in print, about Native American medicine. I remember when my book Maximum Immunity came out in 88, I think, from Houghton Mifflin. It went into six languages. I was so proud of myself. I still have copies of the Swedish edition, the Finnish edition, the Italian edition, the French edition. No, the French stole it. Right, of all the countries, the French took the book and stole it word for word. Some Ganef doctor over there stole the book and put it out under Immunity Maxime, under his own name. You couldn't. But it's unbelievable how many books I've written, how many shows I've done. How many shows have I done? 16 years. What does I do? 300 shows a year? 200 shows a year? I can't even have 3,000 radio shows and all these books. And there's no end to this. Why am I not retired? Answer. Because there's no reason to retire. What would I do? Go on an icebreaker in the Antarctic? I have no idea what to do with myself. I was retired when I was young because my work has always been part of my retirement. In other words, I do what I like, therefore I'm retired. You get what I'm saying? In other words, when I was young, I was traveling all over the world collecting medicinal plants in the South Pacific. Even when the kids were young, I dragged them with me on ships and planes and trains collecting plants. Was it easy? No, it was very hard, but so what? Life is a rocky road, and you just walk and you trip on it, you cut your feet, and you keep going. So that's the end of it. So here I am. Who knows what's left? Who knows what's tomorrow? All I know is I pray my sister gets better. I pray for my children's health, my health, and the nation's health. That's all. Now let's go to the callers. You know, I'm allowed to do this every once in a while, I think. Of the making of many books, there is no end. You know who wrote that? Ecclesiastes. It's written in Ecclesiastes. Of the making of many books, there is no end. Did you know that? It's unbelievable. So what do you want to talk about? Iran, the mosque, Martha's Vineyard. I want to talk about Martha's Vineyard, where the grapes of wrath are not only stored, but the wine from the grapes of wrath is what the Bacchanalians get drunk on every night as they plot the next bubble in order to sucker you in and suck the money out. I mean, the housing bubble created by them, you know that. So what's the next bubble you think that the people on Martha's Vineyard are going to cook up as they drink the next vintage of the grapes of wrath? Hawaii, Jimmy, you're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, you know, back when I got out of college, before I went into the Army, I went up to Martha's Vineyard to be a waiter and paint houses. And that is the elite of the elitist place. You know, they pretty much treat you like crap up there.
In other words, they look down on the working man, even though that's how they get to power, by telling everyone, by giving the speeches that they're for the working man.
Oh yeah. It's where.
No, I know some of the names that play in Martha's Vineyard. I understand it very well. I have no jealousy for it, Jimmy. I live in beautiful properties. It means nothing to me to hang around with these people one way or the other. I'm sure some of them are decent, some of them are indecent. They just happen to be different than you and I in that they have more money. Remember what Hemingway said? The rich are different. No, it was F. Scott Fitzgerald who wrote, "The rich are different than you and I. They have more money." Remember that one?
Yeah. No,
well, that's about it. In other words, they range all over the place. The rich are different than you and I. They have more money. That's all. But they range in type. That's all, just as we do. There's no defining the rich or the elite in any one way that would make any sense, other than they tend to sneer or denigrate the working man, which is ironic in the sense that they use the working man to get where they are politically, and particularly the Democrats, Jimmy. How are things in Hawaii today, since you're calling from there, Jimmy? What island are you on?
I'm on Oahu, right in Honolulu.
I happen to love Honolulu. You know, when I go to the islands, it's where I choose to stay, is Honolulu.
Yeah, it's a good city.
You know, here's the reason. You got a diversity of restaurants. I get very bored easily on like, islands. I did too much of it as a young man. I like Honolulu because I know where to go. I can get into remote areas of Oahu that you would think you're on a lost island. Have you ever been back in Manoa Valley up in the ridges there and gone down the Ko'olau Range?
I live in Manoa, Doctor.
Well, I lived in Manoa, and I used to hike back on the ridges, and I'll tell you, there are people who got lost in there that have never been found. So you say Oahu, people don't realize what's right in the back of the valley from Waikiki, Jimmy.
Yeah, you're right.
Right? Yeah. And the ocean is gorgeous right off, like Waikiki. I like to go swimming. There's a beach I used to love by the Alawai Yacht Harbor. Down by the end there, all of the hippies hang out, smoke the doobies. They're in the trucks and the vans and the surfer kids. They don't work there. How do they make a living without working?
A lot of them work at night in the restaurants and stuff and surf during the day. And I was just down at the beach now. I'm on a break from lunch, and I go down to Ala Moana Beach and swim in the afternoons. You know, I love it.
Right, Ala Moana Beach. It's a beautiful beach. I'm one of the few people who actually enjoys Ala Moana Shopping Center when I go there. The food is very good, by the way, in the food court.
Right, yeah, I love the food
court.
No, it
is. No, if you know where to go, the food court is very... I like food courts in big shopping centers. They're very good.
I agree.
And you know why? Because people who don't have much money are pretty picky about what they eat, by the way. When they're going to spend it, it better be good, and they're not going to go back. Unlike the restaurants that Mayor Bloomberg goes to, where, frankly, they could serve him warmed over you-know-what, and he'd go back to it because it keeps out riffraff like you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to hear from you.
I'm joking. Come on. The one thing I can't stand is poi. I remember when I first got to Hawaii, and, you know, I wanted to go native and eat native food. Ooh, is that stuff horrible. I can't eat it. And even the years I lived in Fiji, they didn't even eat poi. The Fijians took taro, and they cooked the taro root. That I love. To this day, I love taro root. But you can't get it in America in many places. You have to know how to cook it, by the way. Taro root has to be cooked twice. Very tough to cook. You see how strong these Fijian men are? They're like iron men. They're Melanesians. They're like iron men. And the traditional diet was largely consisted of root crops and vegetables and some fish, with the occasional mammal, meaning boar. They would go pig hunting in the mountains with spears, by the way. But the staple food was what I just mentioned to you. So you do is you cut the root up and you boil it. And then you throw the water out, and then you boil it again. Why do you have to do it twice? Because there are microcrystallines in the taro that wind up, that are removed during the cooking process. And if you don't cook it thoroughly, you wind up getting these microcrystalline substances absorbed, and you could damage your kidneys and your intestines. How did the islanders figure out not to eat taro without cooking it twice? To think about the technology and how long it took, what trial and error is. And you know, as a student at the time who studied primitive culture and primitive food and primitive medicine, it's pretty astounding technology when you think about it. And the wisdom of the people who developed these medicines from the wild, or developed the idea of how to cook these foods without killing themselves, is astonishing when you consider how far we have fallen as a species, that people today eat things that they would not feed their dog or their cat. It's interesting. I'm a little sidetracked, but that's okay. It's August. I'm allowed to do it. The other night I had a dream, and I have really amazing dreams. It's almost like going into another world for me. I actually am one of the few people who look forward to my dreams. Some are bad, some are good, but I'm there. And I remember them in the morning because I take a lot of pyridoxine B6, and I dream in color and 3D and in sound. I have incredible home theater in my head. So that dream, I was inside my own blood, and I was watching my own blood course through my body, and I was seeing substances converted into molecules, from food into molecules, and then coursing through my blood. And I remember thinking as I was observing this, I said to myself, why would you want to throw garbage into your circulatory system to begin with? I mean, why? And what I was getting at is, if you actually think about what you're putting in your mouth and where it goes and how it's absorbed, it will change your whole way of looking at the world, because some of the things you're putting in your mouth, I'll start with the obvious, artificial colors, artificial flavors, pesticides. You all know you don't want to put that in your body. But if you could actually visualize or see what these toxins are, you would never, ever eat foods with any of these toxins in them, I said to myself. But then I've written books on this for years, and I used to write it. Now I have only one health book out, you know, Healing Children Naturally, which is on my website. But I had a vision of it. I actually saw it. Think of it this way. The next time you eat a meal, ask yourself, would you want to take plastic garbage bags filled with gunk and absorb those plastic garbage bags in a small form and try to see if your body can handle them? Of course you wouldn't. Well, that's the kind of junk that's in some of the foods that you're eating. That's why I try to eat as organically as possible, and why I love to drink vodka and beer.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. We've been talking about the Ground Zero Mosque. By the way, before we go to Joe Farah, our guest and a good friend of mine, an AP advisory just came out. Now, the Associated Press is one of the most important vehicles of propaganda in the world. They said that the writer should not use the reference Ground Zero Mosque anymore. They're not allowed to use the words Ground Zero Mosque. So the infiltration is complete. Were it not for a few talk radio shows and a few internet outlets, notably Drudge and WorldNet Daily, I don't think we'd have a country left. And joining me right now is Joseph Farah, who happens to be the genius behind WorldNet Daily. Joe, thanks for being with us on the Savage Nation.
Michael, it's a privilege to be with you.
Joe, did you hear that news break I just gave, that AP said that the writer should not use the reference a Ground Zero Mosque?
We saw this, you know, coming with Reuters years ago. And, of course, AP, as you point out, is really the monopoly news organization in the United States of America. Even though the newspaper industry, which supposedly owns it, is collapsing of its own dead weight, the AP is the ubiquitous news service that, that's the source for what appears on television and radio news and so forth. And these guys...
Now, you know why I have you on today. I want to talk about your incredible event in September in Florida, but I can't believe what's going on between you and the right-wing Judy Garland, as she is known, Ann Coulter. What's going on? What's the story? It says Ann Coulter slams Farah. I don't even want to repeat the name she called you, because to me she was just projecting herself in what she said about you. Ann Coulter makes a sick skunk look good, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm very clear as to which side I'm on, Joe. But why would she attack you when you're one of the stalwarts of the conservative movement?
Well, I guess the truth hurts. You know, what I did was confront Ann with an inconsistency in her ideology and what she's always talking about. She takes a speaking engagement with a homosexual conservative Republican organization. Now, to me, that should be an oxymoron, you know. You should not have such a thing. But this is an organization that promotes same-sex marriage. It promotes open homosexuality in the military. Now, why is Ann Coulter going there? And, you know, I asked her these questions. I asked her politely, and her answers were snippy. And, you know, well, they paid me to go, and so I'm going to go, and that's what I do. And I went back to her, and I thought that you were, you know, in this for the convictions, and that this was, is it about the money? And that's just silly. She was very dismissive. Then I wrote her a third letter, Michael, which I haven't shared publicly yet, but it was one of deep personal concern for her, because I think she's, you know, I realize she's gone off the rails. And this is, you know, that I've defended Coulter. You know that I've... We've had conversations off the air, you know, about...
Right. You've told me that I have stopped referring to her after she did Jew baiting with a very liberal broadcaster named Donnie Deutsch, by the way. She Jew baited him on a show. I thought it was one of the lowest points in American media history, and I never referred to her again. I was very, very unhappy with what she had done. But you kept supporting her.
I did. And you know, as usual, Michael, you were right.
Well, I don't want to I really don't want to have to have been right, but I'm telling you, I sensed something with what she did. It was not only that she had such a vicious manner, and she was enjoying toying with him in a way that was a little disturbing, frankly.
That is disturbing, and I'm, you know, I would love to go back and look at the transcript, but... You know, the point is, it wasn't viable anymore for her to be keynoting an event about taking America back, because taking America back is about more than getting Republicans elected. And you know, I had chosen Ann because I thought she was a fiery fighter.
You know, now, wait a minute. Now, you have a big conference coming up, September 17th in Miami. You've got Alan Keyes, you've got Tom Tancredo, you've got Jerome Corsi, Aaron Klein, David Kapelian, Rusty Humphreys, many, many others, and you dumped Ann as the lead speaker because of this dust-up, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. I'd rather have a conference of lesser lights, but who are firm in their convictions, than somebody who, you know, I would be embarrassed to be on the same podium as Ann Coulter. You know, the funny thing, the genesis of this conference, Michael, I don't think I ever told you this. It came after the CPAC event last February, when CPAC invited GoProud to be a sponsor, accepted them, and I don't know if you know this, but Sarah Palin, I know one of your favorite people, and another one of your favorite people, Hannity, withdrew from the conference. We withdrew from the conference because, you know, to me that was like a crazy aberration.
Well, I'd rather stick to the issue of your conference. What are they going to speak about? It's not going to be about her anymore.
Of course not. No, we're very serious about setting a new agenda for America. You know, I just am appalled at the lack of leadership out there. You know, we got to be debating these cultural issues. You know, when a nation can no longer tell right from wrong, there's no distinction between sexes anymore. In fact, we don't even call them sexes now; they're genders, right?
As a journalist, the real journalist, that's the wrong word, isn't it?
Totally the wrong word. And
gender does not apply to humans; it applies to things.
Right. You know, I just don't believe our civilization can stand much longer with this kind of moral decay and moral blindness that we're surrounded by. And it's not just about, you know, I just wrote a book called The Tea Party Manifesto. And the reason
right.
I wrote this book is because I don't want to see the same thing happen to the Tea Party movement that has happened with the Republican Party and the conservative movement. I don't want to see them. What's happening, you know, is we've got a bunch of politicians trying to get out in front of this parade and say, only talk about economic issues. Only talk about economic issues. Well, Michael, we got problems beyond economics. How do we solve those problems if we're only going to talk about economics?
I understand that. But the economics are what the average person thinks about, because if they can't, put meat on the table, so to speak, they're going to be wards of the state. And as you know, the state just keeps printing money. Joe, your event, just before we lose track, I want to stay with the big picture here. You have a big event September 17th in Florida, in Miami, correct?
That's right. It's called Taking America Back. And if you want to find out a lot of information about it, just go to the website, takingamericaback2010.com. And I promise you, Michael, it will be unlike any political or media convention or conference you've ever been to. It's going to be lively, engaging debates. Not just a parade of talking heads up on a podium.
And what about the cruise you have right after it? I know you invited me, and I almost went, and unfortunately I couldn't make it. But you have this amazing tea party at sea. What's that about?
Fantasy that you're going to show up at the last minute. But
I may go down there. I told you I have family reasons to maybe show up.
Party at sea is really a fun event. It's a week long. Cruise through the Caribbean, and of course it'll be smaller than the conference. I think we got about 200 people though on the cruise so far, and these are all hardcore people. And you know, instead of just going out and sightseeing, we every night we get together and we debate the great issues of the day, and it's a lot of fun.
And you're departing the day after the event. You get on the ship and you go out through the Caribbean.
That's right. We have so many repeat customers coming. You know, we've done this is our third year. And each
Joe,
year
let me ask you something. Were you invited to Rush Limbaugh's wedding?
No, I wasn't.
There seems to be a very, very distinct elite group within the so-called conservatives who bash elites all the time. And we know who belongs to that group, Joe, and they weren't invited to the wedding, were they?
I invited them to my wedding. And
you
didn't invite me to any of his weddings.
No, but I mean, you know, it's funny how these conservatives bash the elites, quote unquote, when in fact they have an elite group amongst themselves and they exclude certain people, don't they?
Well, I'm starting to do that. You know, I that doesn't bother me. What bothers me is the direction of this country and the fact that too many of our own, you know, celebrities in this movement are letting it happen. They're missing the big picture. In fact,
Joe,
they're even becoming...
Okay, but let's talk about our own celebrities and the issue of the Ground Zero Mosque. You know where I stand on this. I haven't stopped since it occurred. I've been doing this all week long. Who else is doing it? I noticed Fox News dropped the subject already.
Well, you know why. I mean, you know who owns Fox News.
17% is owned by a Saudi businessman?
That's right. Yeah, and a very loud 17%. Somebody who
one of their talking heads, Neil Cavuto, was talking about fattening foods today instead. I couldn't believe what I was watching.
Well, you talk about who are the people. Who are the high-profile people in this country who are speaking out on the big issues? That's a big issue. This whole, you know, nonsense about confusing the sexes is a big issue. You know, I started, we had this conversation off the air, Michael. There's only a handful of people. It's like you, me, Alan Keyes, Buchanan. I'm running out of names here.
Well, wait a minute. Come on. You know that Matt Drudge still does a great job, correct?
Yeah, but Matt does a great job with his website, but he's not out there talking about these issues.
Right? He's smarter than I am. He decided to not be public about it.
Maybe I should take some cues from Matt, keep my mouth shut.
No. At a certain point, taking a vow of silence when you have a website isn't such a bad idea. Joe, look, we've said everything we need to say about the Ground Zero Mosque, but you know, I've seen your articles as well. The people behind it are very militant, aren't they? This Ralph is on a tour of the Middle East raising money, on taxpayer money. Hillary Clinton is responsible for his trip. The developer is a militant Arab. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't know if you saw Aaron Klein's story today, but they're trying to sanitize this whole thing. They've scrubbed the website. There's no references to there's no biographies of any of these people anymore on their own website. And, you know, it's just, you got the President of the United States speaking out on this. Why is this any of his business? This should be a local matter that should be handled in New York.
Well, that's why 24% of Americans think he's Muslim.
Maybe part of the, yeah, it was a pretty shocking poll.
And by the way, that was done a few days ago. I think that if they did the poll again today, it would be like 32%.
That's right. We're polling on that tomorrow. We want to find out, why do people think he's a Muslim?
Let's start with the fact that his father was a Muslim. I mean, why would we think he isn't?
Right. And he's so fond of the Muslim world.
Does he go to church? You remember Bill Clinton used to have a stage Bible, a fake one that was oversized, created for him in the props department at MGM, I think, for Sundays. He had an oversized Bible with an extra large cross. Remember? And half the time he'd hold the Bible upside down with the cross upside down, so people thought he went to church. But at least he made the appearance that he was going to church. Does Obama even make the appearance that he goes to church?
No, he doesn't. There are a couple of stories about that recently. And, you know, I think, what do you think Bill Clinton had in that big Bible? Do you think maybe he had...
Stop. We're on the air right now, Joe. It was an oversized book, and you could open it up, and you could imagine putting anything inside of it. But let's assume it was the Lord's words in there. But this president, as far as I know, doesn't even make an act of going to church.
No. Well, you know, this whole thing, you know why he chose to go to Jeremiah Wright's church, and he had never been in a church before. He explains it in his book. That was the church that gave him the most potential for community organizing.
Oh, my God.
It was a spiritual decision to go to...
Yeah, a means to an end. Joe, do you think that Jay Sekulow will be successful in suing to stop the building of the mosque?
I am going to tell you this. I don't know if it's Sekulow's suit, but I don't see this mosque getting built. I just don't see it happening. You know, you get Governor Patterson is not in favor of it. He's doing everything
he can. Governor Patterson, Harry Reid, did you know Howard Dean came out against it?
I mean, this is as unpopular as illegal immigration is in this country, but this is an easier thing to fix for these guys.
Yeah, all they got to do is move it. If they really weren't out to agitate and to divide people, they could simply say, we didn't know it would be this controversial, we're sorry we're moving it, and that would be the end of it. But they don't want that. They want to be in our face. It's classic left-wing activity, as far as I can tell. There's a lot more to this mosque than meets the eye. So, Joe, how do people go and find out more about both the event in Florida and the cruise? They go to WorldNet Daily, right?
Go to WND.com. But if you go to TakingAmericaBack2010.com, that will give you more specific info about the conference, and it'll also lead you to the cruise if you're interested in that.
Joe Farah, thanks for being with us on the Savage Nation. Good luck with the Judy Garland of our time.
Thank you, my good friend.
I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. To me, it's part of Western civilization, incidentally. I know, it's crazy, isn't it? You wouldn't think that this is part of Western civilization. It is. Let me ask you something. You think that they let you play this in Saudi Arabia? You think they let you play heavy metal in Saudi Arabia? Now they want to take somebody to a hospital and have his spine cut. It's part of Sharia law. It's unbelievable. It's astounding how you liberals don't even understand. You can't wake up. It's impossible to wake you up. Here we are in the public square talking about the attack upon Western civilization by these agitators who want to take the sacred site of the tragedy of 9/11 and now build a mosque right next to it. No matter what anyone says, they say we're going to build it anyway. And you got Raouf, the mosque leader, on a strange mission to the Middle East collecting money. He says, you know what? I'll raise it wherever I can, even Iran. You don't understand it. You can't put two and two together. You don't understand it. You just don't understand it. You have no idea what's at stake. Instead, you take this fight and you put it into the a concept of Western liberalism, and you say it's about freedom of religion when you don't even understand what it is about. It's not about freedom of religion. There are 100 mosques in New York City. It's not about freedom of religion. It's about desecrating hallowed ground. Shall we use the word desecration? How about a mosque at Arlington National Cemetery a block away? Would that work for you? Would that work for you? How about a mosque at Arlington National Cemetery? Would that be something you might support? You probably say, why not? Well, maybe why not? After all, you don't believe in Western civilization, you libs. You've said, hey, hey, ho, ho, Western civ has got to go. And now, on the dawn of Sharia law throughout the Western world, you might just get your way. And then all you feminists will be put into a burqa. You might be subjected to some surgery you're not expecting. And all of you practitioners of alternate lifestyles may be stoned to death or thrown down a well, but you won't understand it's even happening to you until it is too late, because you don't even understand what battle is going on around you. You're dancing around the golden idol. The golden idol of liberalism is what you're dancing around, and you don't even understand that this is a biblical story come to life all over again. It is as biblical a story as if my ancestors were standing right next to me and they said, oh, Michael, are you so right? I actually feel their presence here in the room. My eyes are closed. I have one hand raised and one hand holding a handheld microphone. I can almost feel Ezekiel. I can almost feel them in the room saying, Michael, tell it like it is. Tell them like it is. They're dancing around the golden idol. They don't even understand what is about to happen to them, Michael. But then again, you would think that I'm touched. And so therefore, I will no longer have this vision on air, because it doesn't translate very well to most of you unless you yourself were in touch with the Holy Spirit, whether it be the Christian Holy Spirit or the Jewish Holy Spirit. I could go into the other religions, but I don't think I have to mention them. I don't have to do the homily. Unless you are, in fact, in tune with the ancient Holy Spirit that breathed life into this land called America, I don't think you understood a word I said. You think it's all an act. And that's the way it's going to be. I once wrote when I was 18 years old in my journal, those who know will always know, and those who don't will never. I remember writing that when I was 18. I didn't even know what it... I just came to me one day. Those who know will always know, and those who don't will never. And I think it's true. I think there are people who are conscious beings, and they're educated beings, and they know what's going on. And then I think that there's an entire mass of people, and it doesn't even matter what level education you have, who have never known anything, and go through life not knowing anything, and will die knowing nothing. They won't even know what they lived through. And I hope that the people listening to this show on a regular basis, who have bought all of my books over the years and listen to these shows on an almost religious basis, are part of the group of those who know, because I think you've always known what's going on. Western culture is hanging by a thread. Western culture hangs like a loose tooth, and the liberals dance around the golden calf. This is the Savage Nation, another day in paradise. God bless America. Let's play something along on the way out, such as Earth Angel, if you can still fire it. If not, a stinger will do.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Yeah.
So you think there is a solution acceptable to all sides?
I think if we work hard enough that we can find one, and if people would stop talking about what's impossible and talk about what could actually happen if people put their heads together, maybe we could find a site that's away from the site now but still serves the catchment area that would be a noble gesture to those who live in the area who suffered after the attack on this country, and at the same time would probably in many ways change a lot of people's minds about Islam, which is really a peaceful religion practiced by peace-loving people.
Mosque is still the big issue. I know that it's being varied by people on Fox to talk about, I think, chicken, fried chicken, restaurants, baseball. Anyway, to me, it's not mosque madness, as some say, but mosque sadness. That a radical imam and a militant Arab developer would attempt to trample on America's raw nerve about 9/11 indicates that this is more than a media phenomenon. The Ground Zero Mosque has touched all thinking Americans who now see more clearly the ongoing battle between militant Islam and the West. You see, with over 100 mosques in New York City, why did these agitators want to provoke America like this? Why did Obama take their side instead of being a diplomatic leader like Governor Patterson, who offered another location in Manhattan? This is another victory mosque that will be viewed throughout the Muslim world as another insult to the liberal weak West. Contrary to Obama and Bloomberg, this is not about freedom of religion, but the site itself. Even the head of Al Arabiya Television calls Ground Zero a cemetery of 9/11 victims and stated this will be a victory for Islamists. Sure, this incident is obscuring Obama's failures on the economy and so many other fronts, but not for much longer. Obama's leaving on yet another vacation to Martha's Vineyard, where the grapes of economic wrath are not only stored, but where they're making vintage wine from the grapes of wrath. The people see it all. We'll keep talking about this and other topics on the show today, but let's stop for a minute. I know you listen because this is one of the last places you can get real, honest, independent, conservative opinions and unfiltered news. And I want you to get the full impact of the Savage Nation. Go to TRN1.com, become a premium member, and get Savage Live, Savage Archives, and the Savage Podcast at TRN1.com. Click on my picture at TRN1.com today. The entire left-wing media is saying that the imam behind the Ground Zero Mosque, Rauf, is a man of peace. But they refuse to report that just after 9/11, he said that the U.S. was an accessory to the attacks.
I wouldn't say that the United States deserved what happened. But the United States policies were an accessory to the crime that happened.
Okay. Are you saying that we're an accessory?
Yes.
How?
Because we have been an accessory to a lot of innocent lives dying in the world. In fact, in the most direct sense, Osama bin Laden is made in the USA.
Have you heard that anywhere recently? Was that reported in your local rag? Even Howard Dean says that it should be built somewhere else.
I think another site would be a better idea. I would look to do that with the cooperation of the people who are trying to build the mosque. This is a very delicate, difficult religious and cultural issue.
That's right. Howard Dean, former head of the DNC, seems to have more sense than Obama and Nancy Pelosi, who's called for a witch hunt against those who oppose the mosque.
This isn't about the rights of Muslims to have a worship center, or Jews or Christians or anybody else to have a place to worship, where any place or Ground Zero. This is something that we ought to be able to work out with people of good faith. And we have to understand that it is a real affront to people who lost their lives, including Muslims. That site doesn't belong to any particular religion. I think a good, reasonable compromise could be worked out without violating the principle that people ought to be able to worship as they see fit.
And naturally, the families of the 9/11 victims are also outraged.
This mosque, it's wrong. It's so wrong.
Our first task at Ground Zero is to simply preserve the sanctity of the site.
I can't let the actions of the passenger and crew of Flight 93 go in vain. As long as they need us to speak for them and to continue the fight that they began, I'll be here to do it.
We promise, never forget. Is that just meaningless words on a bumper sticker faded by the sun? Well, give me a break.
We understand they can build where they want to build. All we ask them to do is to use some good sense and think about what they're doing.
Now, this is a battle between the age of reason and the age of belligerence. Expressing their ignorance as opposed to reason is this talking mouth from CNN.
Timothy McVeigh was raised Catholic. Do we then entertain petitions of moving Catholic churches away from the Oklahoma bombing site? I'm sure you're thinking it sounds ridiculous, but ask yourself, is it ridiculous because Catholicism is familiar to you? Or is your argument that what he did was different? Or is your argument that Timothy McVeigh didn't kill in the name of Allah?
Now that comparison makes no sense whatsoever. And of course, leftist rabbis like Arthur Waskow, never heard of him, have the same lack of reason.
I know how I would feel if people started saying there were certain places you weren't allowed to put up a synagogue. And therefore, I know what should not be done to people who want to put up a cultural center, which will include a prayer space.
Well, at least the governor of New York, Patterson, understands what's going on here.
So many people who normally would understand this issue are very upset by the fact that this is happening. And what that tells me is that the wounds of 9/11 haven't healed. And I think if they haven't, perhaps we can find ways to bring about that healing by perhaps creating a situation where people will feel more comfortable. What I think was wrong after September 11th is that we did not appeal to the religious leaders of the world, all of them, to condemn this act of wanton violence. And so perhaps spiritually, we can get through this period by dialoguing with each other in a way we never have before.
I'm Michael Savage. We'll be right back.
Savage.
A new article from the Heritage Foundation is entitled Solutions for America. Not only does it point out the problems that we have, but offers workable solutions. Joining us now to discuss a few of these solutions is Michael Frank, the VP of Government Relations at the Heritage Foundation. Michael Frank, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be on the show.
So what is your idea behind the solutions?
What we did here is we took a look at a number of the trend lines our country is facing, whether it's on the side of too much debt accumulating, future governmental promises that we'll not be able to meet, the burden of taxation, stresses on our military and national security apparatus, a whole range of these sorts of trend lines, all of them proved alarming to us. And we realized that America really is pretty much at a precipice, at a tipping point, if you would. And the kind of remedy we need that's commensurate with the challenge we face is a very, very large, ambitious, and robust one. And in looking at what was going on here in Washington, we realized that there were precious few lawmakers who seemed not only to be aware of the pending challenges facing America, but also who were willing to take the kind of steps necessary to address them. So we put our collective intellects together here at the Heritage Foundation and came up with a product, a document we called Solutions for America. It is a compendium of about 128 different ideas. Some of them are absolutely revolutionary and would absolutely change the trajectory of this government, what it does, what it should do, and put it on the right kind of a course. And we've published it earlier this week, and we're hoping that it'll attract the attention and pique the curiosity of those folks who are not only in elected office, but those who are seeking it around the country.
And what solutions have you come up with?
Well, the big ones, I think, relate to the size and the scope of our government. And first and foremost, what we realize is that a large part of the spending that goes on every year here in Washington, everything from middle-class entitlements such as Medicare and Social Security to 71 what they call means-tested programs, which are essentially a term of art meaning welfare, that add up to almost $1 trillion a year in spending, are what we call entitlements. An entitlement is basically the creation of a program that entitles a recipient to a benefit if they fit within certain age or income levels of the definition in the law. So lower income people can qualify automatically for programs like food stamps or housing subsidies or Medicaid health assistance. And folks who are over the age of 65 qualify automatically for Medicaid and Social Security benefits, for example. And what we propose is to end that, to end the entitlement status of all these programs, and put, not to end the programs, but to force Congress to grapple every year with the year-to-year changes in the size and the scope of these programs. So if inflation is 1 or 2 or 3% and these programs are growing to 7 or 8 or 9, you can see over time that it'll create more and more of a challenge and a burden on the taxpayer. And so we want Congress to actually have to get its hands around the entire federal budget every single year. And what it'll force them to do is take a look at reforms that'll actually promise to realign the level of government activity, the scale of the promises being made, to what we have in terms of resources with which to pay those things. Right now, there's no alignment whatsoever, and the government is on a course that's unsustainable in the eyes of almost every budget expert on any part of the ideological spectrum.
Hmm.
So that's a big one. We want to do that for welfare as well, and also believe that there's not enough in the way of work requirements in all these programs. We believe there should be a reciprocal obligation on the part of the person receiving the benefit to give something back. And indeed, even a part of the benefit should be received by the recipient as a loan to be repaid in the future once they get up on their feet and are earning a fair wage in the future. So that's a big part of our domestic agenda. We also think that there's a misalignment as between the federal government and the 50 sovereign state governments around the country. The federal government's doing far too many things and taking in too much in the way of power and authority and responsibility in areas like education, transportation policy, homeland security policy, a lot of healthcare areas of policy. And it needs to get out of the way and realign that by giving back the authority and the revenue taken from the states so the states can be the lead actor in all those areas and basically fashion policies that best suit the local conditions in the 50 different states. Utah is, you can imagine, is a much different state in many ways, say, than New York, Florida, and so on. And right now, when the federal government is overarching and overpowerful in these areas, you end up with a one-size-fits-all kind of solution and approach that may only serve one or two states well, but be a disservice to the remaining 48. And we believe the time has long since passed when we have to should recalibrate that relationship between the states and the federal government to give the states a whole lot more running room to do what's best for its citizens.
Well, what are the chances of that happening?
Well, there's a lot going on out there right now. Let me tell you that. If you look around the country at the races that are being waged, you've seen that the American people, sort of the sleeping giant analogy, they've awoken. And I think they realize that they may not be able to say it in the same way I do, but I think they sense that we've passed this, we're at this tipping point, and we've passed the point where it's all theoretical. All these trend lines that we've talked about on and off for years, they're very real and very immediate now. And they're going to directly affect not only us, but our kids and our grandkids. And I think the kind of fervent activism you see out there now, Tea Party movement is a good example of that, is a reflection of this realization that's dawned on so many people. And so when you come through the November elections, at both the federal and the state level, I would think we'll have quite a few more folks who will be receptive to these kinds of messages and ideas. And the real challenge is going to be to have people on the outside of the Beltway, outside of Washington, demanding these kinds of changes and getting their voices heard in Washington. Because if we try to do this solely from within Washington, the large institutions here are far too corrupt and built built upon the status quo. They all contain certain kinds of investments in the flow of money, you know, through the current programs. they'll never change voluntarily. It's going to have to be done for them by the voices of ordinary people up and down the breadth of this great nation.
Any signs that this problem is going to be corrected?
Well, right now, no. Today, this Congressional Budget Office released some more information showing that the annual deficit is $71 billion worse than it had projected just 6 months ago for this year. And over the next decade, it's $250 billion worse than they projected just 6 months ago. So the guys that are in charge of Washington right now are heading in precisely the opposite direction than where we should be going. But in terms of what you see, whether it's in public opinion polls, whether you see looking at various campaigns, the kind of folks who've decided to come forward and run for elective office this election cycle, there's a lot of hope out there. There's a sense that people can't afford to sit on the sidelines any longer and just watch this tragedy unfold. There's a sense on the part of more and more people that I've got to suit up and get on the playing field and try to do what I can to stop this disaster, this catastrophe from happening. And I, my feeling, I'm an optimist, I guess, but my feeling is that after the November elections are done, we'll see a new wave of enthusiasm, fresh thinking, and courageousness that's really lacking here right now.
And Michael Frank, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Thanks, Michael. It's my pleasure to be here and an honor. Thank you.
I'll be right back.
Savage.
Joining us now with an exclusive update is Robert Scott Bell.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be back with you and the Savage Nation audience with a message of health, freedom, and liberty. And I asked the question to start out today's update. Would you like some pharmaceutical tyranny with your French fries? Michael, this is funny. You covered this last week as well. The statin drug for everything and everybody at every age. The drug industry is salivating over the prospect of having statin drugs, that is cholesterol-lowering medication, included in every Happy Meal, along with the growth hormones and antibiotics already present. We're not getting enough drugs, Michael, evidently. Remember those Freedom Fries they came out with? I don't think they would have had statin drugs with them, but that's another story. Of course, we know that statin drugs reducing cholesterol does nothing to really prevent cardiovascular disease because cholesterol isn't the cause of cardiovascular disease. We've got to go deeper into the inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a culture, unfortunately, that has descended upon America that believes that every ailment, every symptom, every burp and hiccup is due to the lack of some synthetic molecule or molecules patented by Big Pharma, approved by the FDA, the Fear and Death Administration, as I like to call them. And then, of course, if we had the right chemicals, the right molecules, everything would be all good, you know, calling Aldous Huxley. And so, you know, you've covered well the cholesterol issue. I don't need to berate that, but it is another aspect of the insanity of a country that used to believe in freedom. And, of course, the freedom maybe even to say no to drugs. Of course, under Obamacare, the ability to say no to medical care, like many millions of Americans are now waking to say, hey, you know, if I break my arm and need it reset, that's fine. That's one thing. But when it comes to the chronic diseases due to lifestyle, due to lack of nutrients, unfortunately, the medical industry, its expertise is not there. Let's just say it like it is. And many of the doctors that have learned nutrition had to do so despite their training, had to go outside of their training to help the people that need it, of course. And we are dealing with a culture that is now, because of our reliance and over-reliance on drugs, is lacking in basic nutrients.
Exactly.
You know, that's a big story that's been breaking, and I've been covering this for years, Michael, and I'm sure you've referenced it. A big story, a world without antibiotics. Now, are you and the Savage Nation audience ready for a world without antibiotics, or does it fill you with fear and dread and panic? Because modern pharmaceutical medicine cannot keep up with the superbugs that they themselves, man, has created. So what happens when the antibiotics no longer work? And I've joked, and I've mentioned it here as well, that we do not suffer from a drug deficiency disease, for instance, right? Heart disease is not evidence of a statin drug deficiency, okay? And some people go, oh, yeah, that's cute, that's silly, but they don't really believe that. And I'm here to tell you they do. They do. And infection is not the result of an antibiotic deficiency. But there's this guy from the antibiotic resistance monitoring and reference laboratory of the Health Protection Agency. this guy named Dr. Livermore, and he says his grandmother died for lack of infection-killing drugs.
You can't be serious.
No, I kid you not. Now, granted, we understand antibiotics can intervene in a crisis, but the point is, the mindset is that the only thing between us and death is an antibiotic, or the only thing between us and any disease is a drug. And of course, it's completely upside down and wrong because it disavows any acknowledgement or knowledge of the law of the terrain or the environment or the milieu. I've referenced it versus the germ theory concept of Louis Pasteur, who acknowledged basically before he died he was wrong. And a contemporary of his, Antoine Béchamp, and also the French physiologist Claude Bernard, they all talked about this law of the terrain, which is the empowering concept and understanding of nature herself, the creation that we all are a part of. That when we have a healthy terrain, healthy life grows in that healthy terrain. When that terrain is lacking in any particular nutrient, mineral, trace mineral that is necessary by God to be there, then disease is the result. It's not a mystery. It's not rocket science. And we look to replenish nutrients rather than replenish drugs for which there is no absence or deficiency in regards to its cause. And so this is what we're looking at here as a Dr. Livermore. Many doctors are saying, oh my gosh, the world is going to end. The sky is falling. No more antibiotics because the resistance is growing. And we recognize, too, that the narrow pathway at which an antibiotic works is something that these so-called bugs, pathogens, can find their way around by expressing new DNA. Hey, that's life. That's creation. Life finds a way to survive. And man, in his arrogance, maybe in his ignorance, thinks that he can conquer nature rather than learn from it and live with it. But perception is reality in the medical profession, where they have apparently, in a large part, forsaken common sense and biological reality for a twilight zone where everything bad that happens to us is because of an absence of some new or old drug.
Sure.
And now the bacterial infection that they're all fearing outside of methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, MRSA, a new gene called New Delhi Metallobalactamase, or NDM1. And I would argue and urge you not to wait for antibiotics to die, or much less kill you, potentially, because they have some nasty side effects as well. And I think, things to alleviate our fear is to recognize that these drugs, or let me say these bugs resistant to drugs, actually are not stronger. I know this is almost heresy to say, because they're super bugs. It's the way the media portrays these things. And yes, they're super in relation to the antibiotic designed to kill them. They're super. They're impenetrable. They turn into little, pathogenic supervillains. But not in relation to things of the natural world. And I've mentioned some of these things here. I'm not here to sell products. I'm just here to share the information that in the natural world, there are botanicals, there are even, metals that are non-toxic in proper forms that can help us to counteract a microbial burden, a pathogenic burden, of which we all may potentially carry. I mean, heck, if we really look at it, the Savage Nation audience could go right now and get a strep test, right? If they still do them this way, they'll put a little swab of the throat, they'll put it in a petri dish to see what grows, and pretty much everybody will test positive for some streptococcus bacteria. We call that the strep throat infection. But I'll hazard a guess, and it's a good one, that the vast majority of the Savage Nation audience right now listening to us do not suffer from a strep throat infection, yet have strep bacteria present in the throat. How is that possible? Why is that possible? Well, that goes back to the heart of the law of the terrain, that when you're basically healthy, you keep things in check. There are more microbes in our body than we have cells in our body, and yet we all survive. How is that possible? Unless there is a symbiosis, there is a way to work together when we are healthy, when we provide the healthy soil.
Right.
Much like those small organic family farmers that are looking to rehab the soil, get the nutrients in there available for the food that they grow so that the food is healthy and it provides and sustains life. It's not rocket science, as I say. This is basic stuff. But in our arrogance and somewhat our ignorance, we think, oh, well, we can do better. Let's throw some nitrogen pellets down there. It's the same thing. And we're not making bombs with it now. We'll throw it on the soil. And of course, it disrupts the normal balance of how nutrients are made available via earthworm, breaking down these things, these complex molecules into ever simpler forms for the body to, assimilate them via the food that they eat. And so where do we go? Do we rely on synthetic chemistry? Do we rely on the way nature has worked ever since there's been nature, by that which created us all? And then we've got more absurdities now. Remember the pandemic that never was, the H1N1 swine flu. Oh my gosh, you know what the World Health Organization did, Michael?
What's happening now?
just recently they declared it over. It's over. We're all going to live.
You don't say, really?
You know, and it's really kind of funny if you think about it, because their own pronouncement, they acknowledge 18,000 deaths worldwide in over a year due to the H1N1. But think about it. Wait a second. Isn't it our own Centers for Disease Creation? I mean, Centers for Disease Control. I always get them mixed up. Says that there are 36,000 deaths annually just in the United States under a year, every year. 36,000. So they claim less than half of that. Less than half of those deaths globally, not just worldwide for the H1N1. How is that a pandemic? And even I would argue that the 36,000 referenced by CDC is a gross exaggeration when you really look at the true death rate to influenza, and not just complications of people who are already ill.
Well, sure, okay.
So how does a bigger than normal super epidemic pandemic flu kill only half as many worldwide as occurs in just one nation every year from the little old regular flu, Michael? And at the end of the link, when we talk about the CDC, and in this case, the World Health Organization pronouncement, Chan, their spokesperson, in her exchange with journalists, also raised the specter of an even deadlier flu pandemic in the future.
No.
Oh, yes, that's right. Since H1N1 was a dud, guess what they're going to bring back? The sequel, H5N1. That's right, they say, and I quote here, "Lurking in the background, we still have H5N1, Chan said, a reference to the bird flu strain that has infected 503 people over 7 years, but not even statistically relevant, and they claim killed 300, which would be, of course, a brutal death rate to that. But, of course, it never went wide like they promised, like they said, like they feared us into, accepting experimental medicines and vaccines. So be afraid. Be very afraid. Not really, of course, when you see through these pronouncements. And thank God for the media and talk radio and even the internet to get this kind of information out there, so that we don't fall victim, fall prey to those with conflicts of interest. Oh, and did you hear this? They admitted massive conflicts of interest that are happening out there. The World Health Organization reveals H1N1 experts' industry ties, including Nancy Cox from the U.S. CDC. She disclosed financial support from drug industry groups. She was on the advisory committee for WHO, and that was a vaccine thing she was promoting. Arnold Monto, a professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also was researching into influenza vaccines for GSK, Novartis, Roche, Baxter, and Sanofi Pasteur. Got grants. Dr. John Wood's research unit at the National Institute for Biological Standards and Control, a center of the UK Health Protection Agency, also performed contractual research for Sanofi Pasteur, CSL, and others. Professor Marion Zambon of the UK Health Protection Agency Center also worked with Novartis, CSL, Sanofi, Baxter, GSK, in her laboratory, and Professor Neil Morris Ferguson acted as a consultant for pharmaceutical firms Roche and GSK Biologicals.
How could this be going on?
These are the people that are dictating policy at WHO, and it's the same scenario as we find it at CDC and FDA, and they pretend conflicts of interest don't matter. I don't believe it. Do you? And of course, the pandemic that never was, at least it's finally over. And wrapping up this, actually, I talk about a 100-year war. Do you know what Obama did last week? He sent out emails. In fact, email, if you're on his email list, you got this.
What did it say?
Listen to this quote from Barack Obama. "We fought for and won historic reforms to our healthcare system. A victory 100 years in the making." Michael, this is interesting. He referenced 100 years of victory, 100-year victory in the making. What was he referring to? Of course, Savage Nation listeners are savvy to this because we've covered it, Michael. It's the Flexner Report of 1910, the Rockefeller-inspired and funded preordained report that was intended to wipe out all competition to petrochemical pharmaceutical medicine. The Flexner Report, 100 years ago, 1910, now we are at 2010. I don't know if Obama actually knows what he wrote or somebody wrote this for him, but somebody in there knows exactly what they've been doing. I call the 20th century the century that we descended into pharmaceutical tyranny into the 21st, and Obama admits it. And you've heard it first right here on the Savage Nation. Drug resistance, I think that should be the people resisting the drugs, not the resistance of the microbes, which was inevitable. My feeling is that we should not seek permission to do that which is our birthright. Unless you think you're owned by big government, then of course their permission for you to refuse drugs is well, required if they own you. But your doctor, by virtue of his license, is technically owned by government because they've asked permission to do that, which I believe is a birthright, healing. And I realize that they say freedom is too dangerous. Too dangerous. Of course, it's the elitists, the global elitists that want the one world order. They don't want freedom.
Well, thanks for the report, Robert.
Thanks again, Michael. Always great to be with you on the Savage Nation with this message of health, freedom, and liberty. Please urge your listeners to go to robertscottbell.com and plug into all this and more, for freedom is on the line.
I'll be right back.
Savage.
I'm calling this From the Age of Reason to the Age of Belligerence because one of the principal reasons the West has lost is because of the loss of reason, as evidenced by statements that are made, even by those in the media. For example, today a statement was made by a spokesmouth on CNN who tried to compare the building of a mosque on Ground Zero to the theoretical construction of a Catholic church at the Oklahoma bombing site because Timothy McVeigh was a Catholic. It made no sense whatsoever. There's no logical comparison. This is one example, amongst many, of the loss of reason, even among the so-called educated folks in the media. What we have instead is an age of belligerence, where people make false statements on the basis of their belief that they are correct. There are no consequences for these false statements, and as a result, people don't care about responsibility. There are no consequences to their behavior. They cannot follow any logic as to what they are doing and what it may lead to. They have been taught in our schools to have no reason, to not believe in logic, to simply follow their feelings. If it feels good, do it. Why not do it in the road? All of the propaganda of the 60s has come home to roost, even amongst our leadership. Witness Obama. He makes statements and doesn't even give a damn about their consequences. He takes vacations without understanding the debilitating effect it has on the American people, millions of whom are out of work. And then we have the clash of civilizations, the liberal left versus the belligerent Muslim countries. Who do you think is going to win when you have liberals in the West who continuously bend over backwards to explain away the belligerence of the Muslim world? Who wins that battle? Can you play that one out on your logic board? Now, you know, many of you don't even understand what this is all about. You hear that the Muslims want to impose Sharia law and you could care less. You don't know what it is. Let me give you an example in the news today. A Saudi judge is considering paralysis punishment. A Saudi judge has asked several hospitals in Saudi Arabia whether they could damage a man's spinal cord as punishment after he was convicted of attacking another man with a cleaver and paralyzing him, the brother of the victim said Thursday. A man was left paralyzed and subsequently lost a foot after a fight more than 2 years ago. He asked a judge to impose an equivalent of punishment on his attacker under Islamic law, meaning Sharia law. He said one of the hospitals responded that it is possible to damage the spinal cord, but it added that the operation would have to be done at another more specialized facility. Administrative offices of two of the hospitals in the court were closed for the Saudi weekend and could not be reached for comment. So Saudi Arabia, as you well know, enforces strict Islamic law, meaning Sharia law, dummy, and occasionally doles out punishments based on the ancient legal code of an eye for an eye. The query by the court about paralyzing a man is among the most unusual and extreme to have been made public in the kingdom. And this highlights the attempt in Saudi Arabia to balance a push to modernize the country, bring it up, let's say, to the 6th century from the 5th, while still holding on to their superior religious traditions that include abusing women, forcing clitorectomies on women, etc.
From cultural paralysis to literal paralysis.
Yeah, the brother said the judge asked at least two hospitals for a medical opinion on whether surgeons could render the attacker's spinal cord non-functional. Khalid al-Mutari, age 27, said the assailant was sentenced to 14 months in prison for the attack. He said the attacker then got a job as a school teacher. He said, we're asking for our legal right under Islamic law. A Saudi newspaper said that one hospital said that he couldn't do the operation. There's ethical grounds not to paralyze a man. But Islamic law, so-called Sharia law, applied in Saudi Arabia, permits defendants to ask for a similar punishment for harms inflicted on them. Cutting off the hands of thieves, for example, is common. They don't want just blood money, which would be acceptable under Sharia law. No, they want him paralyzed. Human rights groups say trials in Saudi Arabia fall far below international standards. Ooh. For example, what did they do under Sharia law? Crucifying the headless body of a condemned man in a public place is a way to set an example, according to the kingdom's strict interpretation of Islam, the kind of interpretation that's being spread amongst mosques in America. Amnesty International took time out from attacking Israel to say they were concerned over this report of paralyzing a man in a hospital. We're very concerned, and we will appeal to the authorities not to carry out such punishment. Sharif said this was the first time Amnesty International had heard of a punishment involving the damaging of a spinal cord. According to Amnesty, in 2005, a convict in the kingdom had his teeth pulled out by a dentist because he had smashed another man's teeth out. We've also seen cases of people sentenced to blindness because they have caused the blindness of another person. Well, that's understandable. It's Sharia law, the kind of law that they would like to impose here in America. Welcome to the fifth century.
Savage.